Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. During baseball's last weekend of regular season play, you will hear the sound of relieved division winners, delighted fans, and if you listen very closely, the sound of the Boston Red Sox whistling past the graveyard of dead playoff teams.
No, I think the focus is still the same as we're going out there and focusing on tonight's game and, you know, just play as hard as we can and try and get the win.
Ahead on Only a Game, the latest in the MLB playoff races. Also coming up, 16-year-old golf phenom Lexi Thompson takes aim at the LPGA Tour, a celebration of boxing films, and kilts and large rocks fly at the Highland Games World Championship. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It was a night which saw a lot of chances disappear, a night upon which baseball's playoff picture became clear, or clearer at least. As a result of beating the Marlins 4-1 last night, the Milwaukee Brewers established themselves as winners in the National League Central Division. The Texas Rangers beat the Mariners 5-3 to achieve the same distinction in the AL West, and the Arizona Diamondbacks beat the Giants 3-1 to become champs in the NL West. Last year, Arizona was last in that division. Atlanta took a step toward advancing to the playoffs by beating the Nationals 7-4. The Braves assume a 3-game lead over the Cardinals in the wild card race. Meanwhile, in the American League, the Red Sox, who were rained out in New York, got help from the Toronto Blue Jays, who beat Tampa Bay 5-1, and from the Athletics, who beat the Angels 3-1. In the AL wild card race, Boston now leads the Rays by 2.5 and the Angels by 3.5. Anybody arriving at Fenway Park Wednesday evening for Boston's last home game of the regular season would certainly have characterized the atmosphere as festive. In the street outside the park, as the Dixieland Band played on, a big creature made of red and white balloons was swaying in the breeze. Sausages and pepper steaks sizzled on numerous grills. Between a couple of those grills, former Red Sox pitcher Luis Tiant, looking like a mustachioed Cuban Buddha, was signing autographs and posing for photos. Meanwhile, inside the park, a couple of hours before the game against the last-place Baltimore Orioles would transpire, the Red Sox took fielding practice. They'd frittered away all but 2 games of the 9-game lead they'd held over Tampa Bay in the wild card race at the beginning of the month, so fielding practice was an excellent idea. It could have been argued that they needed batting practice and base running practice too, and pitching practice, or at least a couple of healthy pitchers. But beside the Boston dugout, as if everything was just fine, catcher Jared Saltalamacchia was obliging some youngsters by signing autographs and clowning.
Can you sign my jersey?
No, don't sign the microphone,
can you sign
please.
My hat and jersey, please? Cole Crawford, may you please sign my jersey?
After Saltalamacchia had scrawled a final signature, I asked him if he enjoyed the drill.
Yeah, oh, it's awesome.
Any decline in autograph seekers as the lead has dwindled?
No, not that I know of, you know. We come to the ballpark, and it's nice for the fans to be able to interact with us and us interact with them.
I didn't doubt that. Still, Boston had just lost 2 in a row to the Orioles and 6 of 7 to the Rays. They were 5-15 for September. Surely coming to the ballpark under those circumstances couldn't be the same as it would have been if Boston hadn't kicked away all those games.
I think the focus is still the same as we're going out there and focusing on tonight's game and, just play as hard as we can and try and get the win.
It sounded like the party line to me, an impression that was reinforced when veteran Boston knuckleballer Tim Wakefield, who had thrown about 11 pitches Jared Saltalamacchia couldn't catch in one of those losses, whistled essentially the same tune.
Everybody's good. You know, it's like, you know, for me, with experience, I think I've been here before, so it's a matter of, pulling from past experiences and winning today and worrying about today only. And if, you know, when tomorrow comes, then you worry about tomorrow. So that's kind of been my attitude.
The slide from virtual lock on the playoffs via the wild card toward October irrelevance put Red Sox fans in an odd position, since wild card contender Tampa Bay had a critical handful of late September games against the Yankees. Sox fans had to cheer for New York, or they had to try to, or something.
No, absolutely not. But in this case, I think I could a little bit.
That hurts. But we'll do what we got to do to get to the playoffs.
I can't. I don't even have it in my blood to even root for them at all. I know it'll get them where they need to be, the Red Sox where they need to be, but still, you know, it's hard to do, but maybe I'll do it for them.
Obviously, those fans found themselves counting on the Yankees because for weeks they have been unable to count on the Red Sox, who have blown late-inning leads, allowed the opposition to run them out of games, and generally looked as if they didn't belong in October. Nick Cafardo, who's been following the team for the Boston Globe, felt the fundamentals weren't the only things the Sox were missing.
The Tampa Bay Rays are a great example of a team that has a $42 million payroll, and the manager, Joe Maddon, gets every ounce of blood and sweat and tears out of those guys, and you just don't see that here in Boston for some reason.
On Wednesday night, Cafardo characterized the home team as tense.
It's not just one guy. Everybody has that moment where they just don't look good in the field, and they can say all they want that, yeah, we're trying hard, blah, 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 but sometimes the play on the field where they, you know, where they miss cutoff guys, they're throwing to the wrong base, they're misplaying balls, all those things give you an indication that their head just isn't in it.
All that aside, Nick Cafardo figured that with their ace on the mound Wednesday night, the Red Sox would begin to turn things around by beating the Orioles. They didn't, and the final out seemed emblematic of the month of fecklessness. It came on a dribbler back to the pitcher. At that point, Sox followers could take some solace from the fact that on the same day, the Yankees knocked off the Rays twice. Boston had actually gained half a game on Tampa Bay by losing. But that was not a strategy likely to inspire even the most optimistic fan. The Red Sox face the division-winning Yankees today and tomorrow in New York.
We've fallen down. The Red Sox have fallen down. We've fallen down like Louis.
Yesterday, the NBA made official what we all knew was coming. The league postponed training camps indefinitely and canceled 43 preseason games. It's uncertain whether negotiation can save the regular season, which is still scheduled to begin November 1st. Meanwhile, the WNBA season has rolled on unimpeded and the playoffs are underway. In the best of three Western Conference finals, the Minnesota Lynx enjoy a one-game lead over the Phoenix Mercury, and in the East, the Indiana Fever hold the same advantage over the Atlanta Dream. Here to discuss the WNBA season, which has perhaps quietly progressed to its penultimate playoff series, is Clay Callum, who covers the league for FullCourtPress.com. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be back.
The Indiana Fever are just one game away from the WNBA Finals. Indiana was the runner-up back in 2009. What accounts for the team's success this season?
A lot of things, really. They have Tamika Catching, who was just named the most valuable player, and they're a very strong team, a very veteran team. The East was a little weak this year. The team they're playing, the Atlanta Dream, was missing one of its key players, Sencha Little, for much of the season. She was late coming back from Europe, and then when she got here, she was hurt. So the Dream just really didn't kick it into gear till the second half of the season, and now they're all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals. But Indiana is a very strong team, well coached by Lynn Dunn, and again, that veteran experience is always important.
Just 3 years ago, the Atlanta Dream posted a record of 4-30 in their inaugural season, and now two wins away from a finals berth. To what do you attribute quick improvement there?
Angel McCoutry, number one draft pick. That's what happens when you're terrible. McCoutry's a great player. Nice trade for a minty price. Picked up Sencha Little. Erica D'Souza came back from Brazil. All of a sudden, you got yourself a really good team.
How will Atlanta respond in Game 2 tomorrow?
Atlanta is one of those teams that if they're playing well, they're very, very difficult to stop. McCoutry only played 17 minutes in Thursday night's game, because of foul trouble. In fact, she fouled out in 17 minutes. And you take the best player out of the game, and it's really going to hurt you. I don't think the Fever are at all overconfident. Atlanta, in many ways, has superior talent. They don't have as much experience.
Minnesota thoroughly outplayed Phoenix during Thursday's Game 1 of the Western Conference Finals. The Lynx were an impressive 27-7 during the regular season, but apparently the team isn't satisfied with those accomplishments?
Apparently not, but they're very young. This is a really interesting series. Phoenix is truly the classic team that holds its own fate in its own hands. If the Mercury are scoring, you can't stop them. I mean, they could put 100 up. Minnesota's problem is they have never won a playoff series before this year. Though they have individuals who have done well in postseason, as a team, they have no postseason success. Phoenix has won WNBA titles. So even though Minnesota does have more talent, that experience edge comes into play again.
Clay, you have said that the level of play this year in the WNBA is the highest it's ever been. Is this because there's a better college talent pool than there's ever been before coming into the league?
Yes and no. The coaching is better. There are a lot of veteran players who've been in the league a long time. The college talent pool might not be producing superstars every year, but the chances of going to a random WNBA game and seeing a very good game between two talented opponents who are well coached and play hard for 40 minutes is very, very high. It's really been a surprise to longtime observers that there's been this sudden jump. There's no obvious explanation for it, but it's clearly there.
Given the quality of play, has the popularity of the league increased commensurately?
Now, that's really hard to say because the WNBA, like all the niche sports and even some of the major sports, is trying to find its way in a just dismal economic situation. I think supporters of the WNBA would say, look, if the economy was booming, we'd be selling a lot more tickets. It's in a death spiral, some would say, and we're holding steady and maybe improving a little. So it sort of depends on your perspective of what a reasonable expectation would be. Another thing that's happened is two franchises have been sold from one private investor to another private investor, meaning that there's actually a market for these franchises.
All right, time now for the question that has to come at the end of a conversation like this. Which two teams advance to the finals and who takes the crown?
Well, I think Indiana is going to outlast Atlanta, and given the results in the first game, and I think Minnesota will make it into the finals. But Indiana's experience is going to trump Minnesota's youth. And also Indiana has a little more post presence than the Lynx. And in the end, I think that'll be the difference in the five-game series.
Clay Callum covers women's basketball for Full Court Press, and he joins us from time to time to discuss the WNBA. Clay, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Always a pleasure.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. What do two-time winners of the Boston Marathon do when they're no longer running competitively? Well, Jeff Smith, who won the race in 1984 and again in 1985, is committed to breaking the Guinness record for the largest gathering of mobile Santa Clauses. On December 10th, Smith hopes that at least 15,000 runners will dress up as Santa and participate in the Santa Sightings Fun Run in New Bedford, Massachusetts. We're appealing to the couch potatoes who might not want to run 5 kilometers, but who would like to dress up as Santa Claus, Smith said. Aspiring Santas who lack the requisite gear will be provided with Santa suits when they register for the race. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, Celluloid Boxing Heroes and Villains. But first, until 6 days ago, Paula Creamer, who has been making a fine living on the Ladies Professional Golf Tour for 8 years, was the youngest woman ever to win an LPGA event. Creamer was 18 when she notched her first victory in 2005. But when Lexi Thompson cruised to victory in last week's Navistar LPGA Classic by 5 shots, Thompson, trailed by her grinning father, the caddy, was 16. It might be an exaggeration to say that Thompson's victory was not a surprise, but perhaps not much of an exaggeration. Joining me now to discuss that matter and others relating to Lexi Thompson is Alan Shipnuck of Sports Illustrated and Golf.com. Alan, welcome back to Only a Game.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Though she is only 16, Lexi Thompson did not exactly come out of nowhere. When she was just 14, she shared the lead in the 2009 Navistar LPGA Classic after 2 rounds, and I understand that she's done quite well at qualifying school, too.
Well, yeah, and she's had a presence on the LPGA going back to when she was 12. I mean, she's been a can't-miss prospect for a while, and it was never a question of if, you know, merely when. And given the learning curve she's displayed, it's really not a surprise that she won this year. It won't be a surprise if she wins a bunch next year. I mean, she's going to be the number one player in women's golf at some point. She's just a tremendous package of power, touch, imagination. You know, she grew up with 2 brothers, one's on the PGA Tour, one is a stud college player, and she grew up trying to compete with them and beat them, and she has tremendous competitive fire, and she's going to be a star, there's no doubt about it.
According to the LPGA's rules, competitors must be 18 to join the tour, but wouldn't the association be doing itself an enormous favor by bending those rules to take advantage of Ms. Thompson's achievement, assuming she wants to play on the tour right now?
Well, she does want to play, and her agent is working feverishly behind the scenes to make it happen. And I think they'll hammer out a compromise here in the next few weeks. Clearly, women's golf needs a young, telegenic American star, and the tour needs Thompson more than Thompson needs a tour, really. So, you know, Lexi Thompson is not interested in going to college. She's not Michelle Wee with a lot of outside interests. It's not a knock on her, but golf is her life. She wants to play golf. It would be a monumental upset if she's not a full-time player on the LPGA next year.
Obviously, Lexi Thompson's story is a good golf story and a good prodigy story. How does it rate as a father-daughter story?
Well, it's refreshing because he's not overly invested in it like you see a lot of these little league dads in various sports, whether it's golf or tennis or soccer. Clearly, he's proud of her, and he's pushed her along when she's needed. But Lexi is really a very self-motivated athlete. There's a cute moment on the final round. She was trying to decide between shots, and, you know, Dad kind of argued for a more conservative play, and she just completely ignored him and, you know, grabbed the club she wanted and took a whack at it. And she'll outgrow Dad soon. I mean, if she's on the tour next year full-time, I expect her to have a professional caddy, and Dad will be on the other side of the ropes.
Alan, do you have any sense of how some of the veterans on the LPGA Tour feel about a 16-year-old girl taking home the top prize on Sunday?
Well, golf is the ultimate meritocracy. You know, you have to kill what you eat. And, you know, Lexi shot the lowest score. She deserves to win. There's some misgivings about bending the rules for her to be granted full-time status next year just as a precedent. But I think everyone recognizes Lexi as a unique individual, not just her talent level, but also the way she's come up. And, you know, there's some maternal instincts. I mean, Julie Inkster has daughters who are older than Lexi Thompson. So certainly some of the older players are protective of her, and they do worry, you know, what this means for her development as a person and all that. But in general, women's golf, it's a niche of a niche, and the tour has been struggling to survive, and I think everyone recognizes that Lexi Thompson can really move the needle for the tour. She can be a player that the casual sports fan is attracted to, and so there's enough of a big picture sense that I think most of the players recognize this is a great development for the LPGA.
What's your best guess about how the LPGA will handle the phenomenon of Lexi Thompson?
I think they're just going to bow to the reality of the situation that she's already won. That gives her playing status. She went through the, prior to her victory, she went through the first stage of qualifying school, and she won it by 10 shots. I mean, it's really just, it's a mockery to make her continue on this process. She just blew away the field. How can you say she's not ready to play the LPGA? And I think it'll get hammered out in some sort of legalese, and there'll be a resolution, and we'll deal with the next one whenever we have to. I don't think there's going to be a flood of tweens who suddenly are petitioning the LPGA. I mean, this is the benchmark. Okay, if you win a tournament and you're 16, then we'll consider it. Otherwise, you know, enjoy high school and we'll see you when you're 18.
It's perhaps not fair to ask you to predict Lexi Thompson's future, but I can't resist. Are we looking at the next Nancy Lopez, Annika Sorenstam, or Lorena Ochoa?
I think so. It doesn't mean it's going to happen next year or the year after that, but, you know, certainly, you know, she's built like an Olympic swimmer. I mean, she's 6 feet tall. She's got broad shoulders. She's just a tremendous athlete, tremendous power. There's two or three players in LPGA that have that kind of power. You know, Michelle Wee is one. Brittany Lincecum is the other. But, you know, she's driving at 310, 320 off the tee, and the par fours out there are barely 400 yards. So if she can just keep improving her wedge game, she's going to make an incredible number of birdies. And there's also, it's an important thing, she enjoys the spotlight. Annika struggled with that for a long time. You know, on the men's side, whether it's Nick Price or Fred Couples, a number of players have gone to number one and they haven't really enjoyed it. But I think Lexi wants to be in that role. She has some big sponsors behind her. There's going to be a lot of buzz, and I think she's going to surf on that. That's going to help push her along. Instead of adding pressure, as maybe it did in the case of Michelle Wee, I think it'll add motivation and excitement. And I really do think she's going to be a dominant player pretty soon.
Alan Shipnuck writes for Sports Illustrated and Golf.com. He's also the co-author of the recently published novel, The Swinger. Alan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thanks, Bill.
You can hear my voice each week. I bet you didn't know that I can hear yours, but that's only true if you leave a comment about the show on our listener line. To do that, please call 617-353-1860. Rocky, with his arms raised triumphant at the top of the steps to the Philadelphia Art Museum. Hilary Swank's Maggie hammered by a sucker punch and falling as Clint Eastwood's Frankie frantically tries to pull the stool out of her way. Marlon Brando's Terry Malloy tearfully contending that he could have been a contender. Boxing has inspired a lot of filmmakers, and according to Ledger Grinden, the author of Knockout, The Boxer and Boxing in American Cinema, those films have much to teach us. Ledger Grinden joins me now from Middlebury, Vermont. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for inviting me to come.
Some boxing films are gritty. Fat City, for example, comes to mind, a film in which nobody triumphs and everybody seems to be either brain damaged, drunk, or deluded. Others are basically cartoonish. In the Rocky films, the punches, which occur in slow motion and sound like cannon shots, are so explosive that nobody could really survive them. Given the range, how did you go about generalizing about boxing films?
Well, Bill, first, I depended upon my pleasure in watching movies, and I watched a lot of boxing films. And definitely there are some wonderful ones, also some that are not so good. But the key thing I focused on was the key dramatic conflicts that I thought were arising out of each film. As I saw 20, 30, finally 70 boxing films to write this book, I think I was able to make some general conclusions that I hope the reader will find persuasive.
Let's listen to a few moments from Rocky. We'll pick it up at a point where Rocky is courting Adrian, the woman who will become his wife, or I guess it's a form of courting.
I gotta go now, but don't you leave town, huh? Wish me luck. I'm going to need it.
Good luck.
Say, Adrian, you don't think this robe here is too baggy, you know?
Good luck.
Don't leave town.
You write that, quote, the boxing film is founded on a series of dramatic conflicts that represent widespread social problems. But can something that ambitious and profound really be said of the Rocky films that Sylvester Stallone made?
Well, sure. I think Rocky is looking for self-respect. And I think that when people watch Rocky, one reason it tugs at their heartstrings is because they feel like an underdog oftentimes in our own life and in some sense want to go the distance, even if we don't become a champion.
The simple dramatic distinction between knocking a guy out and being the guy who gets knocked out, notwithstanding, you have written that boxing movies represent, and I'm quoting now, a quest for spiritual alternatives to the physical. What led you to that conclusion?
Well, when I first started writing about boxing films, I thought they'd be a celebration of the boxer's physical power and strength. And indeed, some of them are, like Hard Times, for instance, from 1975. But most of them bring the boxer to the peak of his power and prowess or to a championship status, oh, sometimes half or two-thirds of the way through the film. And then the balance of the film is about the boxer's decline. And like any athlete, when he sees his physical powers fading, on the one hand, there's a sense of desperation and frustration. And on the other hand, he has to turn to other things, romance, family, maybe even some thoughtfulness, in order to give some sort of meaning or justification to his life. And so this conflict between physical power and more intangible, one might even say spiritual values, usually is an important factor in boxing films, especially the conclusion of those films.
In most boxing movies, women are at best a distraction and at worst the ruin of the champ. Everyone knows the scene from Rocky in which the trainer, played by Burgess Meredith, tells his fighter that women weaken the legs. But one exception to that rule is evident in Million Dollar Baby, which features Frankie, played by Clint Eastwood, training Maggie Fitzgerald, played by Hilary Swank.
If I take you on, you don't say anything, you don't question me. You don't ask why, you don't say anything except maybe, yes, Frankie. And I'm going to try to forget the fact that you're a girl.
That's all I ask.
In what ways did that movie, featuring a female boxer, conform to the patterns that you found in more traditional boxing films?
Well, you know, Maggie, of course, gets knocked out in a foul play, and then Frankie and Maggie are in the hospital together. Frankie has to turn to something that's aside from the body, and has to find something in his special relationship to Maggie that attempts to make up for the failures he had with his own wife and daughter. And so it requires a type of a spiritual redemption, and it's often embodied in his love of Yeats, the poet. And so the end of the film also follows this pattern of trying to find substances in life that's apart from physical domination. And, of course, that special relationship between Frankie and Maggie is the basis for that special love and affection that they discover in each other.
Boxing captures the attention of the public when the heavyweight champion is a larger-than-life figure, Joe Louis, for example, or Muhammad Ali, of course. Let's listen to a little bit of Ali from the documentary When We Were Kings, which chronicles the 1974 fight in Zaire between Ali and George Foreman.
I'm going to retire the heavyweight champion of the world. September the 25th, the world will be stunned. That's right. If you think the world was surprised when Nixon resigned, wait till I kick Foreman's behind.
Now, today, most people couldn't name the heavyweight champion. Does the state of the sport have anything to do with the production of good movies set in boxing?
I think definitely so. Of course, in the 1930s, there were over 100 boxing films made, and part of that was a result of the popularity of the sport. And certainly, at the end of the decade, the popularity of Joe Louis is a great champion. And Ali himself, although it took a while to catch on, boxing films weren't central to the 1960s. But, of course, in Rocky, Apollo Creed is a surrogate for Muhammad Ali. And in many ways, the success of the Rocky films are done in conjunction with Ali's impact as a boxer, even though it follows a little bit after his peak as a fighter. And certainly, if another champion appeared on the boxing scene that could really capture the public imagination outside of the ring itself, as Ali and Joe Louis did, I'm sure we'd have more films that would be modeled on those characters, if not specifically about them.
Who among the documentarians has been especially successful at bringing the sport to the screen, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I do like When We Were Kings very much, and I'm glad you chose an excerpt from that. But I'd also point to a film made by Barbara Koppel in 1993 called The Fallen Champ, about Mike Tyson. And among the interesting things about it is Koppel, a distinguished documentary filmmaker, offers a woman's perspective on Tyson's rise and then his fall, which in and of itself is interesting. But the film is also divided between the early parts of the film, where Tyson learns his craft as a fighter and rises in the ring, and he gains the audience's sympathy as somebody who's pulling himself up by his bootstraps. And then the later parts of the film, which have to do with his fall, the rape trial, and finally his incarceration, which, you know, turns us in many ways against Tyson. But I know in my experience talking about that film to students and elsewhere, it's very interesting because people come away with it with rather different views of Tyson. And on the one hand, I think Barbara Koppel's female sensibility offers an interesting perspective on this male dynamo. And Tyson is treated in a much more complicated way than he usually is. I'd recommend that film, The Fallen Champ, to anybody, especially those interested in boxing.
In the epilogue of Knockout, you conclude that, quote, boxing is the sport that is proven to be best suited for films. And as you've said, that's partly because the conflict between two fighters is so elemental. But tell me about some of the other things that are attractive to filmmakers.
Oh, definitely. I think the close-up action, the idea that you can plant your camera around the ring, a relatively small space, and even move it inside the ring, can make the boxing action itself very dynamic. Whereas by contrast with a sport like football, which is a good sport for television, but you can't gain that type of intimacy, I think, among the competitors in football that you can in boxing. Maybe you'd have to do it in an interview after the game. Whereas a film like Raging Bull, you feel like you're in the ring with Jake LaMotta.
Ledger Grinden is professor of film and media culture at Middlebury College, and he's the author of Knockout, The Boxer and Boxing in American Cinema. The book is published by University Press of Mississippi, and the author joined me from Middlebury, Vermont. Professor Grinden, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It was fun.
It's the eye of a tiger, dream of a fight, rising up to challenge a rival.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Following a game in July, fans of the Turkish soccer team Fenerbahce stormed the field and attacked security guards and reporters. The Turkish Soccer Federation initially responded by banning all fans from the team's matches. The federation later decided to allow women and children to attend matches, though no men were to be admitted. On Tuesday night, 41,000 women and children cheered, sang the team's anthems, and behaved themselves beautifully as Fenerbahce played to a 1-1 draw with Manaspor. Several of the players were especially pleased at the lack of jeering. "The memory will stay with me forever," Fenerbahce captain Alex de Sousa said. "It's not always you see so many women and children in one game." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Live Free or Haggis, New Hampshire hosts the Highland Games World Championships. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce via phone this week for our conversation about the news. Hello, Charlie.
It's not Scottish, it's crap.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. I could hear it coming even over the phone line. The NBA has announced that the start of training camps and the first week of exhibition games will be postponed. So, are you shocked, shocked?
This is the beginning of a steady drip, drip, drip of things that aren't going to happen. Very soon you'll be hearing that the first couple of weeks of the regular season aren't going to happen, and then I think eventually you're going to wind up with a 50-game NBA season.
Kobe Bryant has been offered $6.7 million to play basketball in Italy next season, so let's think about this. It's Italy. I hear the food is pretty good. You got your art. You got your classic architecture, and Oh, yeah, $6.7 million. Think he'll go?
Listen, if I recall correctly, that's where his father played.
Yes, it is.
The legendary Joe Jellybean Bryant, so there's some family history there, too. Maybe his father can get him a good deal on an apartment. I wouldn't be surprised to see him play there.
For $6.7 million, I bet he can get a really nice apartment.
Yeah, but you got to let Dad be a big-time swinger.
On Wednesday, the New York Yankees clinched a spot in the postseason. They will finish atop the AL East, in no small part due to the achievements of reliever Mariano Rivera, who saved his record-breaking 602nd game on Monday night. Not a bad guy to have in your bullpen.
No, not a bad guy to have in your bullpen, and not a bad guy, period. If you really want to root for somebody who's worth rooting for, it's Mariano Rivera, who may very well be the best of all time at what he does.
In the National League wildcard race, the Cardinals are nipping at the heels of the Braves. You think St. Louis can catch Atlanta?
I think they can, and Atlanta better thank its lucky stars that everyone's paying attention to how the Red Sox are falling apart, because Atlanta's falling apart.
Manny Ramirez, who retired rather than serve a 100-game suspension for his second positive test for a performance-enhancing drug, announced that he would play this winter in the Dominican Republic. And then I guess he learned that Major League Baseball's reach extends even to the Cibao Eagles.
Yes, LBJ sent in the Marines, and apparently Major League Baseball sent in the Enforcement Division. So he can't, because he's technically under suspension, he can't play there. So now he's going to offer to serve the 100 games for any team that will hire a 40-year-old designated hitter who is drug-tainted.
Rookie quarterback Cam Newton of the Carolina Panthers set the record for most yards passing over the first 2 weeks of an NFL season, and boy, I hope he relished setting that record, because he only got to hold on to it for about 2 hours. You think he had time to throw a little soiree before Tom Brady broke the record that Cam had just broken?
I would hope so. The problem, of course, the difference between the two, of course, is that Brady's team has won both games and Newton's team has lost both games.
In other NFL news, all 32 teams received a memo from the league this week warning of fines and suspensions for players who fake injuries. I wonder, is the league afraid the NFL is becoming too much like Italian soccer?
Well, the problem, of course, is that is the technique du jour to stop hurry-up offenses, like the one played, for example, by the New England Patriots under Tom Brady. So, yeah, apparently the NFL, having jiggered its rules to produce high-passing, fast-moving offenses, is now going to find a way to keep the defense from dishonestly slowing them down.
I don't think the NFL should worry until its players begin clutching their knees when they fall, no matter where they've been hit.
Yeah, apparently the technique of choice in the NFL is to lie down flat on your face for a while.
Then they have something to learn from Italian soccer.
We're dealing in soccer, especially in European soccer, of course, with tradition, with opera traditions that are longer and deeper than that in the United States. So,
Charlie, last week we both predicted that by this week the Big 12 might have imploded. Not exactly, but they have rid themselves of Commissioner Dan Beebe, and they've announced a plan to stabilize their membership by making future departing schools leave behind their TV rights for 6 years. Oklahoma President David Boren called the proposal, quote, very strong handcuffs. I just have to wonder whether handcuffs make for happy partnerships.
Well, apparently that's the only option they have left. And Oklahoma, of course, is the only team remaining in the Big 12 that anybody wants to see play football.
Nevin Shapiro, currently in jail for running a Ponzi scheme, claims that he started providing University of Miami players with cars, money, and prostitutes because former Two Live Crew frontman Luther Campbell couldn't or wouldn't do it anymore. Mr. Campbell and his lawyers seem to think this constitutes slander and defamation. You agree?
Yes, I'm trying to figure out exactly what the basis for the slander charge is. I think Luther Campbell is saying that his reputation as a bag man has been damaged by Nevin Shapiro.
And going forward, that would be a terrible thing. The National Hockey League preseason got underway this week, and the league's new dean of discipline is already hard at work. On Thursday, Brendan Shanahan banned Flyers forward Jody Shelley for 10 games for his hit from behind on Toronto's Darryl Boyce, and Calgary's Pierre-Luc Letourneau-Leblond was suspended for 5 games for his hit from behind on Vancouver's Matt Claxton. Can we expect this new focus on safety to survive beyond the first week of the preseason?
Well, this could be safely called the Sidney Crosby rule, because they are responding to a series of injuries, that one of which took out the best, most promising young player of the last 20 years. I hope so. I have great hopes in Brendan Shanahan, who has played relatively cleanly through his entire career and I think knows the difference between cheap shots and real hockey.
And finally, I can understand how people might confuse Sports Illustrated with People magazine this week, because Brad Pitt is on the cover of SI. What, no athletes have recently done anything of note?
Yes, the movie version of Michael Lewis's Moneyball has come out to a great sensation among both the sports and entertainment press. I have, as I have told other people, I have only one question about the movie Moneyball. Who is it that are playing Tim Hudson and Barry Zito? Because they're two of the reasons anybody ever heard of Billy Bean.
Charlie Fierce is the author of Idiot America and various other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Quite often, where there's something that is hit or caught or hurled, a person or a team is crowned the champion of the world. New Hampshire's a peculiar spot for crowning of that sort, especially when the champions are meeting for a sport that first appeared in Scotland, as the country's history claims. I speak, of course, of those events that make the Highland Games. The best in all the world convened there seeking greater glory, and Karen Given showed up too, and now she has the story.
One weekend every September, visitors to Loon Mountain Ski Resort in Lincoln, New Hampshire, can stand under the Kangamangus Express quad chairlift, close their eyes, and imagine themselves in the highlands of Scotland. The air is crisp, the sound of bagpipes floats by on the wind, and a big guy in a skirt is about to pick up a 16-pound river rock and fling it across a grassy field.
As we said, it'll be hard to beat this one.
These are the New Hampshire Highland Games, where a dozen or so of the best professionals in the sport gather every fall to test their strength and skill. But 2011 is special. New Hampshire is hosting the 31st International Highland Games Federation World Championship, which means visitors aren't just seeing very good competitors, says former world champion Francis Brebner. They're seeing the best.
Competing here is the best period. It's then in a ranking system to ensure that the best's here. They're going to make the cut. If they don't, they're not invited.
The competitors have all their expenses covered by the games, and there's a $38,000 prize purse on the line. Not bad for 3 days' worth of work. Anne Brebner says the competition for the world championship title is just as fierce as the competition for which festival will win the right to host the world championship.
We're actually booked up till 2015 for the championships, you know.
Kind of like the Olympics.
Yes, just like the Olympics each year. You know, it could be in Australia, it could be New Zealand. You'll find Scots people in every neck of the woods, so to speak, you know.
Dressed in a blue and red kilt, accessorized with hot pink knee socks and bike shorts, rookie Matt Vincent from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, isn't one of those Scots people.
No, not at all. I think I have French heritage. I'm really an outcast.
Is that what the pink socks are?
That's it. I just like to keep it light, have a good time. I don't throw well or do anything real well if I take it too serious. So it's not so serious. We're all in skirts.
Like most of the weekend's competitors, Vincent didn't come to this sport because it was in his blood. After competing in the shot put, discus, and hammer at LSU, he just wanted to find his way back to throwing. Ray DeMonte, one of the weekend's sponsors, didn't come to this event through his heritage either.
My motto is, what Scottish game is complete without an Italian award? And so they win the DeMonte Cup.
DeMonte is clearly proud of these athletes, and the International Highland Games Federation works hard to make sure it stays that way. These throwers are drug tested at random throughout the season, and again before and after the World Championship.
We got smart, hard-working people, a lot of firemen, a lot of policemen, a lot of farmers, construction workers, steel workers, and they all have that day job and do this for fun.
Yeah! Matt Vincent certainly seems like he's having fun, as his second throw comes within a few inches of a new world championship record. As Vincent lines up for his third and final attempt, announcer David Webster abandons any semblance of impartiality and works up the crowd.
So cheer, cheer, cheer to your heart's content that we might get a record. Come on, Matt. We want the record. Come on, then. Come on. Let's see it. Come on now.
Just as with his first try, Vincent's final effort is disqualified. Even with only one legal throw, he wins the competition easily and watches with a smile as the officials measure his last attempt, which would have been a record had he not stepped over the line.
Oh, dearie dear. You know, it would bring a tear to a glass eye.
Even more tear-worthy, this is Vincent's first competition as a professional. Had he thrown like he did today at the Amateur World Championship this summer, he would have set a new amateur world record and earned a cash prize. But Hans Lokema from the Netherlands isn't worried about such things.
I get lots of money. I can retire next week, actually. No, of course not.
Lokema didn't discover the Highland Games until his late 30s, when he saw a demonstration in his hometown. 8 years later, he says he loves everything about this sport. Just don't ask him to tell you what tartan he's wearing.
I have no idea. I just picked one. I just called the guy and I said I need a kilt. And he sent me over a kilt. I paid him some money and that's it. I have no idea what tartan it is.
It doesn't matter.
No.
Do you like the colors?
Oh, that's not bad.
Bill Crawford, chairman of the athletics committee, says it doesn't matter what tartan a competitor chooses to wear. Clan affiliations aren't followed, nor is that old Scottish tradition that dictates a man shouldn't wear anything under his kilt.
No, they have to wear something. They're turning and the things are flying around. That's poor form.
Crawford is more than just the athletic director for the games. He's also a former pro thrower, and he's a great resource if you can catch him between phone calls. On the first day of the games, his Scotland the Brave ringtone sounded 114 times.
But you were saying you see these... Oh!
Good throw.
Hello?
Daniel McKim is the reigning American champion, and as such, he's the favorite to win the world championship. But don't worry, he's not giving up his day job.
When I'm not doing this, I'm a hand model. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not a hand model.
I would suspect you've got pretty big
hands.
Yeah,
calluses and broken fingernails and stuff. No.
McKim spends his days in a small cubicle, managing a portfolio of commercial mortgages for a bank in Kansas City, Missouri. He says at 6'5" and 300 pounds, his coworkers compare him to Mr. Incredible. He, too, started out as a shot put and discus thrower in college. But how did he learn to toss the caber, a 20-foot-long log that looks a bit like a telephone pole?
A lot of time in the gym, and a lot of time, honestly, just watching video, getting online, watching some of the guys that have come before you.
There probably aren't many caber toss coaches from where you're from.
No, there definitely are not. So it's a lot of going out in the field and just trying to figure the crazy thing out yourself.
Up. Can you do it? Can you do it? Look at that caber skid along the ground. It's just, it must be heartbreaking for the competitors.
Heartbreaking for the competitors, but it's just about right for athletic director Bill Crawford. He prides himself on choosing good competition cabers, and because today is the world championship, he picked one that's 20 feet long and weighs 145 pounds.
As they would say in Scotland, it's a dour stick. It's a dour stick. In other words, a lot of times you pick up cabers that has a little movement in it, and you can feel it against your shoulder. It's like a rock. You pick it up, you can't feel it. You don't know where you are.
Crawford doesn't take pleasure in the disappointment of the athletes. After all, he's a former professional himself. But he says it's easier on the judges if only one or two throwers manage to get the caber to turn over.
Plus, too, you've seen there's been several failures, and then somebody tosses it. It's a big, big noise.
Yeah, the crowd loves it. Everyone gets really excited.
Yes, this is the signature of Highland Games. Here we go. Over. That's what it sounds like when you get a really huge caber toss. You hear the excited athlete in the background. The thing that you want to do is actually separate out the crowd of athletes. And that's what this caber does.
Rookie Matt Vincent manages to flip the caber, as does American champion Daniel McKim. And as announcer David Webster's been predicting all along, McKim walks away with a world championship title. It's not surprising that Webster can pick the winner. He's also considered the foremost Highland Games historian and has been involved with the World Championship since the very beginning. In 1995, Queen Elizabeth awarded him the Order of the British Empire for his contributions to the sport, which has grown beyond his expectations.
We now have 20-plus games in Germany. We've got 15 in the Netherlands, we've got in Belgium, Switzerland, France, all these do Highland Games now. America is the best. They've got the most games, they've got more than Scotland now.
The fact that there's an American atop the world rankings of a decidedly Scottish sport doesn't bother Webster in the least. After all, that's one of the reasons he started the World Championship 31 years ago.
Well, you know, every country likes to think that they're the best. We thought in Scotland that we were the best, and we were at that time. People in Scotland had phony championships. I'm not saying it was wrong, but, you know, they'd give it a title. Now we can say this title is justified. They're coming. We are looking at the scores. We're selecting the best men, and we're doing drug testing. You can be proud nowadays to win a world title.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jillian Guy, but we had help this week from Sarah Ray at Middlebury College. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's Highland Games photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Dutch Highland gamer Hans Lokema, who shockingly admits that he's not overly fond of the bagpipes.
Yeah, well, sometimes there is some guy going on all day, and I wish, get the hell out of here, you know? Or 200 feet away, that's the best.
It's distressing when a lowlander doesn't take the high road, isn't it? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.